I'd like to start by thanking Peter for the invitation. I'm honored to be here this morning. I'd also like to thank Monica and the rest of the team for all the hard work bringing us all together here. It's a real pleasure to see everyone. One of the great challenges we face in the field of book arts is how to make our work relevant to the present moment. How do we take the arts and crafts of the book that we are deeply invested in and find ways to produce not just beautiful books, but books that are essential to modern life? In a world going more and more digital, can we find a path for our work to become not just collected and loved by a relatively few, but desired by many? A great example of the book arts made immediately relevant, in my view, is the Combat Paper Project. Many of you know of their work with vets, where they take old uniforms, cut them down into small pieces, and beat them into pulp, and make works of art that reflect on their experiences taking part in war. The work with the hands, the transformation of old uniforms into something new, the shared witnessing, are often healing for men and women struggling to fit back into normal society after their intense experiences in the military. But the Combat Paper Project's greatest success, in my view, is not in their work with vets per se, but in how their work with paper compels the rest of us to listen to the warriors, to pay close attention as they tell us what it does to a person's heart and soul to take part in war. If we do not listen, they say to us, we will continue to send our sons and daughters, our wives and husbands, into the insanity that is war. Whatever I have accomplished in my career as a hand paper maker, I cannot hold a candle to these guys when it comes to making the craft I love relevant and compelling to contemporary society. In that regard, they are my heroes and my role models. Much of my own work over the last 30 years has focused on 15th century European papers. Their stable condition, surface character, color, suppleness, and what I perceive to be their integrity and authenticity have always intrigued me. In an attempt to discover the secrets behind these qualities, I've recently completed non-destructive analysis of 1,578 historical papers made between the 14th and the 19th centuries. I'm not going to go into much detail about the project today, but if you Google Barrett, Paper Through Time, at the top of the search results list, you should find a link to the Paper Through Time site, a screenshot of which you see here. We found that papers made prior to 1500 had significantly higher levels of calcium and gelatin in them. But just adding more calcium or gelatin to the paper is not going to give us the authenticity and aesthetic moxie evident in these papers. But if it's not the ingredients that make this paper in these books so attractive, what is it? I think part of the secret is that they were both made to be used. In their moment in history, they were, in a very real sense, a utilitarian commodity, as compared with the luxury limited edition fine press or artist book of today. These historical books were made, and made well, but they were made to be used rather than stored on a shelf and handled only occasionally. We can see evidence of their continued use, and we see signs that the primary goal was to get the paper and the finished book into someone's hands for consumption, not first and foremost to make a beautiful book object. A handmade paper might have dings in it, but they are evidence of the rapid production driven by the demand for paper at the time. They are evidence of the hunger for books and what they contain. Book studies scholars Ann Blair at Harvard, Adam Hooks at the University of Iowa, and others are increasingly interested in how the act of reading a book commonly included writing in its margins so the reader could engage directly and converse with the author. Historical hand-printed books were used in a way modern fine press books are not. The book, the paper, the printing seem to say, "Pick me up. Gather in the knowledge and ideas I have on my pages." So the question for me is, if one wanted to make manifest that same spirit, that aesthetic, how would one do it in today's society and economy? Part of the answer, it seems to me, is to make a lot of paper and make it in a hurry, the way it used to be made, without the self-conscious attention to detail that has become the hallmark of much contemporary hand papermaking. So that is what we are up to at the UI Center for the Book of late. We are attempting to use a three-person team to make paper at historical production rates of 100 to 200 sheets an hour. Instead of the old linen and hempen rags used historically, which are very difficult to obtain free of synthetic fibers, we work with textile quality hemp or cotton fiber, which is cut into 2.5 millimeter lengths, cooked and beaten to a pulp in 10-pound batches. At this point, I want to stop and show you a section of a video we're working on that will give you a better idea of what we're up to. And we should hear a little bit of sound. I'm going to over-narrate this because we don't have a soundtrack yet. Okay, so what you see here, if you're not familiar with the history of papermaking, is a typical three-person team at the vat. One person forming sheets, there's a pair of two molds and one decal, second person couching, and the third person laying. Mary here is working from a post of pressed sheets. And you'll quickly see that everybody's working in unison. Now, someone with a background in papermaking could look at this and readily say, well, it's nothing new. That's just the point, is to see what we can learn about early production techniques, what it was like in the craft at the time, and for me, especially, to see how this rate of production impacts the aesthetics of the finished sheet. Now, you're looking right now at about 100 to 200 sheets an hour. In other words, in 15 minutes, we can make about 50 sheets. Curiously enough, what drives the speed of this operation is not the skill of the people at work. It's the rate at which the pulp drains. This has always been a problem in papermaking and still is in modern machine papermaking. If the pulp drains slowly, you have to slow down the paper machine. If it drains quickly, you can speed up the process. Now, this routine continues until we've made 50 sheets, at which point everybody stops. And the people working at the vat person and the coocher, add more pulp to the vat. And the post, as it's called, will go into the press to squeeze out the excess water. This particular pulp is the textile quality cotton. You know, in my papermaking classes, you can tell people about how this process used to work. You can show them slides from Lalande or other 18th century French papermaking manuals, but if you bring everybody out to the shop and they all take turns doing this, it really, really impresses you. 100 to 200 sheets an hour works out to 1,500 or 2,000 sheets in a day, so it certainly can be done. One of the first things that hit us is that you run out of pulp in a hurry. 10 pounds of pulp is gone in 3 hours. You need a lot of pulp. Okay, so this is the end of, this is 50 sheets. This now goes into the press. This press generates about 40 tons of pressure, which Howie Clark at Twin Rocker calculates was about the maximum amount of pressure a wooden screw or iron screw hand press could generate. And as soon as this comes out of the press post goes back to the layer, and everybody goes right back to work again. This is the way it would go, historically, until the team at the vat had finished so many posts for a day, and then they could go home, work in the garden, get drunk, whatever they wanted to do at that point in the day. So once the sheets are accumulated at the tail end of the day, the pack of pressed sheets goes into a screw press, and additional excess water is squeezed out. Make it weep a little bit. It's surprising. You can squeeze this quite hard and they will not stick together. The press pack is then separated into loose spurs of about 4 sheets, and then it's taken up to a drying loft. Now, another thing that hit us right away was we got hundreds and hundreds of sheets floating around. I mean, you're generating a lot of paper and you got to dry the bloody stuff. Not only that, you see, normally, as many of you know, when you dry handmade, many people today to dry handmade paper would dry it between blotters under restraint. But when you have 300 or 400 sheets of paper, you can't do that. The other thing that hit us right away is after drying, this stuff gets all cockled. And our immediate reaction, well, how are we going to get this stuff all flat? We can't re-dry it between blotters. And then it occurred to us, historically, they probably brought the second day's production up into the loft, and the humidity coming off from today's paper helped soften the paper from yesterday. So that's exactly what we've done. We humidify the drying space, And after about 5 or 6 hours, the sheets have softened enough that they can indeed be taken down and stacked. This is after humidification, so they're stacked. And we actually go through a process of exchange, so that different sheets are faced up against other sheets. But these are all at this point soft enough that they can be taken in to the screw press and pressed. Later on, they'll be taken out, they'll be exchanged again, put back in the screw press, and in this way, we're able to get them dry and flat. It doesn't actually happen quite that fast. There we go. So, here you have a ream of this finished paper. It's not what I want yet. The surface of the sheets don't always have the active grainy surface I see in the historical sheets. Another more important issue is that most of these sheets are second quality because the formation is not as good as we'd like it to be. That is, the appearance of the laid and chain lines and the watermarks are not always clear and distinct, but we are working on that. Now, I detect a question in the minds of some members of the audience. Yo, Tim, how much, man? How much does it cost? An 18 by 24 inch sheet from Twin Rock or a carriage house is about $8. And these sheets are half that size, so for sheets made of commercial cotton rag sheet pulp, $4 per sheet for first, $5 a sheet for paper made from the textile quality hemp or cotton fiber, as low as $1 a sheet in ream quantities for broke, meaning third quality sheets. More on pricing at our table at the book fair. So let's say someone likes this idea of this more quickly made utilitarian intended as commodity paper. What would the counterpart utilitarian book be? In partial answer, I would offer the work of Iowa City artist David Dunlap. David started keeping a notebook in his hip pocket in 1970. He writes or draws in them whenever he chooses during the day, when on the phone, when talking with others, when alone. When one gets filled, he immediately starts another. These books, for me, are an excellent example of life as art and art as life. David is currently writing and drawing in notebook number 704. In various configurations, the notebooks are often components in David's installation work. So we have the obvious example of the notebook or the sketchbook. Shauna Leno's own exceptional binding work does her in good stead when she makes and thoroughly uses her own books for drawings and ideas. So instead of mass-produced notebooks, perhaps people might be more inclined to invest in a small book of handmade paper. One plans a special trip with a special other person or wants to document a life-changing event like the birth of a child. But what would be our examples of utilitarian printed books? Perhaps a favorite text that we want to have and keep and use and write annotations in. Or a wedding certificate and blank pages in which guests can write congratulations and thoughts. Or a family genealogy, printed and distributed to family members and used to collect signatures and recollections. But who in blazes is going to pay for a hand-printed book on handmade paper and then turn around and write in it? Ah, well, that depends on matching the reader with the text she or he wants to interact with by reading and writing, or simply holding and reading and sharing on a regular basis. And here's where, as papermakers and printers, we need to think outside of the box a bit and use the digital media to our advantage. How about if you had an online publishing house that solicited customers but only printed on a subscription basis, or only printed the text customers specify and were willing to pay 50% down on? Sand Bay Publishing is an imaginary business, but my colleague Sarah Sowers in Iowa City calls my alternate universe printing house. In this hypothetical online business, the printer sets the due date for final customer subscriptions, then prints an edition size that exactly matches the orders. Crazy? Well, perhaps, but the idea is to find ways to put the exact books people want to use directly into the hands of a prepaying clientele of known number. So I offer this aesthetic of the more quickly made utilitarian book, not in opposition to the more perfected limited edition fine press or artist book, but as an alternative that attempts to connect more directly with the long history of paper and book making and consumption. On that note, I want to end with this image of Peter and Donna Thomas. As many of you know, they have been traveling around the country in their hand-built caravan doing workshops and lectures. At the same time, they have been taking the pulse of the book arts in America. During a recent visit to Iowa City, I asked them what their read was on the book arts. Was it increasing, I asked, holding its own, or perhaps slowing down a bit? Peter was quick to reply that activity is definitely on the uptake. But more importantly, he said, they had begun to notice a coalescing of people into groups of like-minded specialists. Some focused on limited edition artist books, or one-of-a-kind artist books. Others into democratic multiples like zines. Still others deeply engaged in highly refined, exquisite letterpress editions. If Peter and Donna's observations are accurate, and I expect they are, something similar is likely happening internationally as well. Distinct schools of thought, activity, and aesthetics are developing in the book arts. And that, in my view, is a sign of the development of a vital new field and a profession with great promise. This is all being driven, I am convinced, by the relentless rise of the wondrous but ethereal digital cloud. Handmade books and paper have always linked us directly to our fellow humans and ultimately to nature and the cosmos where the materials of their making originated. As you walk around the book fair this afternoon and see the diverse array of work representing us all, consider the ironic but very real possibility that in a world going still more and more digital, we who make books and paper will soon become not forgotten, ignored, or optional, but increasingly essential to our culture. Thank you. Okay, we have 5 more minutes before a break. Now, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I have up in front some samples of the chancery paper that we've been making, some samples of historical papers that are kind of the inspiration for the papermaking we're doing now, and a few samples of the prototype utilitarian book, printed or otherwise. I'll get those out in a moment. Should we take 3 or 4 minutes for questions, or anybody have any questions or comments? Yes. Now this, I'm glad you asked that question. The question was, do you size the paper? And in fact, there's part of the video that I didn't show you for lack of time showing us doing gelatin sizing. And Russell Moret and I are very interested in just this question because one of the books I have up in front, printed by Sarah Sowers, Sarah tried to print on our gelatin size sheets and it was really a pain. If you printed it dry, it didn't work. If you dampened it, it started to cockle and cause all kinds of problems. But if she printed on an unsized sheet, it printed very nicely. If you gelatin size the sheet after printing, then you get a really tough, strong sheet that you can write on in the margins. Now, there's some real evidence that this is what was done historically. And Russell may explain to you, or not, depending on what he has planned, his efforts to print on this Czech paper. It required washing the paper repeatedly to get it soft enough, but when he finished printing on it, which went beautifully, it didn't have the snap. It didn't have that kind of integrity. So the notion here is that historically, the sizing was people were printing on waterleaf after 1500 probably. Now, when we analyze these papers, there's gelatin in them, and almost all of them. So the question is, well, who's putting the gelatin in the paper and why? Well, it was probably the printer, and there are some historical records of this being done. Why? So people could write in the margins, which was expected. It was part of reading historically. And furthermore, it made the paper much tougher and stronger, which is something the binders may have expected. Yes?
I'm curious about,
the students, you mean? Yeah. Well, I tell you, I have to beat them away with a stick. They really want to be engaged in this. It's one of the things that's very interesting about this is when you're making your own paper by hand and you're doing the sheet forming and the couching and the pressing and the laying and all that stuff, you get disconnected from those various steps. But if you're at the vat making sheets, you very quickly learn to develop your shape because it's the only thing you're doing, one sheet right after the next, and you get good at it. That's one reason it's attractive, but it also connects you with the past and the history of all this in a really compelling way. I mean, this is the way it was done for 5 centuries, you know, and I often tell my students, if you want to start a great handmade paper collection, any book you buy in any bookstore anywhere in the world with a publication date prior to 1800 is absolutely guaranteed to be on handmade paper. It cannot be otherwise. And often booksellers, as you know, have a shelf of stuff they can't get rid of because of the author or the subject is just not of interest to most people coming into the store. So they enjoy it. But one of the reasons we're having trouble with formation quality is that we're not working at this on a daily basis. It's usually once a week. The rest of the week we're involved in flattening the paper, or we have classes, or we're teaching, or we have committee meetings. So we're not doing this on a really routine basis, and we're not skilled at all of the steps in the process. Yes? Well, as near as I can tell, there were seasonal aspects to gelatin sizing, which could cause problems if it was done at the wrong time of the year, and seasonal aspects sometimes to pulp preparation, because you needed to have a steady water flow to produce that pulp. So sometimes it was beaten and stored in the spring and made into paper later. Also, very interesting questions about what happens to paper if it freezes during drying, because I've had that happen to some of my handmade paper, and it turned out beautifully white, much whiter than the... Basically, because the freezing interfered with the hydrogen bonding going on, you got a lighter, softer sheet. The printer who was working with it said, I don't know what you did to that paper, but it's fabulous. I need a lot more of it. And I thought, I can't freeze all this stuff for this guy. But in Northern Europe, that might have been the standard. Yes. Yeah, she's saying that a lot of the paper mills in Europe were in the mountains where it would be cold, and certainly that would affect. You know, I'll just say, in terms of climate, this business about humidifying the drying loft, you know, you see these engravings of drying lofts and paper mills with all the shutters, you know, and you think, oh, yes, well, those were open to let the breeze blow in to dry the paper. Well, on the contrary, this was environmentally controlled drying. You might actually shut all those on purpose so that it got very humid in the loft, particularly if it's dry and breezy and warm outside, and then later open them up. I'm happy to answer all your questions. I'm going to get some things out up in front, so over break, if you'd like to come up and talk, please do so. And thank you again very much.